turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. And this episode is going to be a recording of the message that I preached to the church in which I pastor recently from Revelation chapter 13. And of course, Revelation chapter 13 is a highly written about passage and preached on very often, because in it, of course, is the beasts of Revelation, the beast out of the earth and the beast out of the sea. And the number 666, which is the number of the beast, and the taking of the marks, and all this kind of thing. And of course, there's all kinds of fanciful interpretations and futurist interpretations regarding these things. And of course, you will find that I do not hold to those necessarily, but you will be able to hear a decent exposition, I think, of this from a preterist perspective. So stay tuned for Revelation chapter 6. And if you like the show and you want to support the show, there's all kinds of ways you can do that. You can see a link in the show notes, as well as a tab on the part of the website where you can punch on that, and then it'll show you all the ways in which you can support the show. I appreciate you doing that. And then without further ado, let's go ahead and listen to this recording of Revelation chapter 3. Like I said, we're going to be in Revelation chapter 13 today, so if you want to turn over there while I'm giving a little bit of introduction, you can do that. Now, of course, anytime that there is a fight, anytime that there is a war, so to speak, there are the good guys and the bad guys. There are the enemies and there are the allies. If you look back at any kind of war in history, you'll see that there are allies and there are enemies. And so it's not surprising that when we get to a spiritual battle, we get to a spiritual war, that there are enemies of the people of God. And we're going to look today at what that is. And it's interesting, I started early with my children with some catechisms, even before they were able to start in some of the books that we use for training them in doctrine and theology. I started when they were really, really little by saying things like, do you love the Bible? Yes. Do you love Jesus? Yes. Do you love the church? Yes. Do you love Satan? No. You know, and they would get to, at first, you know, they were yes, because everything was yes, right? Yes, 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 yes. Do you love Satan? Yes. I said, no, we don't love Satan. He's the enemy, you know. And so I'd work with them. Well, after a while, they'd get it, you know, and I'd interchange, and I'd say first, you know, do you love the Bible? Yes. Do you love Satan? No, you know. And so they got used to that. Well, it's a good way of training us that there is an enemy of God's people. And sometimes we get complacent in our life and we realize that, or we forget to realize that that is actually the case. But it is true that there is an enemy of God's people. Now in chapter 13 of the book of Revelation, we will see a glimpse of the enemy of God's people and the way in which he works his way in history. And to kind of catch us up to speed on where we are, we looked last time at chapter 7. And so chapter 8, we have the first four trumpets. And this again is a re-emphasis of chapter 6 and the seal judgments that were placed upon the people of Israel in the first Jewish war. Chapter 9, the Romans are compared to a group of locusts, innumerable amount of locusts that are gathered against God's people to fight against them, devastation of the Jews that result from that. Chapter 10, we're identified with the mystery of God almost being complete and bringing to close an end of an age. And then chapter 11, the temple is destroyed and trampled upon. And then chapter 12, the vision starts with the birth of Christ and this dragon that is going to try to destroy Christ. And of course, the picture that we find there is that this dragon is a symbol for Satan himself. And we know that in the early days, there was Herod the Great, who obviously under the inspiration of the devil, tried to slaughter all the children that would be born about the time that Jesus was born so that they might destroy Jesus himself. But of course, Jesus, his father is warned in a dream and they go down to Egypt. And I believe that is pictured in chapter 12 of the book of Revelation. And that brings us then to chapter 13. Now, if there's any book in the book of Revelation other than chapter 20 that causes fanciful ideas and all kinds of books that are written and all kinds of ideas about what is going to happen and all kinds of allegations and speculations, it's chapter 13. And the reason for that is that we see two beasts that occur there, and we see a number of the beasts, the 666. And if you've read anything about prophecy, anything about things of eschatology, you will come across all kinds of understandings of what this 666 is and the image of the beasts and all of these different kinds of things. And I'm going to take a stab at trying to explain this. And you'll have to understand, first of all, that there are the greatest Bible scholars today who differ on these views. And so to think that your pastor knows everything is a misunderstanding of his ability. And so I will do my best to explain the position that I hold to and then draw it to an application that I think the applications are true regardless of the interpretation that you take from the chapters. And so that's where we will close. And so let's go ahead and look at what these beasts are. And the first beast that we see is the beast out of the sea. And it's described in the first part of chapter 13. It says, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea." Now, usually in the scriptures, when a sea is referred to, it is an image that is supposed to conjure up the Gentiles. There is usually a difference that is made between the land and the sea. And the land is referred to often as the people of Israel, the land of Israel, the promised land. But the Gentiles typically are associated with the sea. And that probably goes way back to the sea people that came into the land of Canaan back in ancient times. And so it was considered that the Gentiles, the enemies of God, were those who came upon the sea. And so here we see this picture of this sea monster coming out of the sea. And this seems to represent Gentiles. And so we have a Gentiles here pictured. Satan's influence is upon the Gentiles. We'll see this when it talks about the dragon giving it power. But the rest of verse 1, it says that he's having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads blasphemous names. So if you want to picture for a moment this beast coming out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So what is this picture that is supposed to be? Well, the 10 horns could simply be symbolic for full power. We know that the number 10 can carry the idea of being a powerful number. But more likely, it refers to the 10 regions within the Roman Empire. Revelation chapter 17, verses 12 and 13 seems to speak to this as well. And interestingly enough, the Roman Empire at the time of Nero had basically 10 regions. There was the Italian region, the Asian region, the Achaea region, the Syria region, the Egyptian region, the African region, the Spain region, the Gaul region, the Britain region, and the Germanic region. And so it's supposed to be a symbol for the 10 regions within the Roman Empire. And each of these horns had a crown upon them. And the crown were, I mentioned earlier, there was two types of crowns, the Stephanus crown and the diadem crown. This is the diadem crown, the royal crown. So it seems to indicate that these are rulers of a type or a ruler of a type. And it says that they have heads and blasphemous names upon the heads. It's interesting to note that the Roman emperors required the worship of themselves, and they would take upon themselves names that were divine names. In fact, you've heard the name Augustus Caesar. Well, Augustus itself is the name that means one to be worshipped. They also took names like Divus, which means God, or Deus and Theos, all of which mean God. And so they would claim for themselves divinity, and I think that's what's referred to here when it's talking about the blasphemous names. And they had seven heads. And again, chapter 17 is instructive for us, and we'll turn to there in just a moment to look at that. But the seven here, seven heads, I believe refers to the seven Roman emperors that had taken place or that were currently around at the time of which John is writing. That would be Julius Caesar, Augustus Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, Gaius Caligula, Claudius Caesar, Nero Caesar, and then Galba Caesar, who took place after that. And then we see that to add complication to this puzzle of who these things are, the description not only is of a seven-headed beast coming out of the sea with 10 horns, but it also looks like a lion, it looks like a leopard, and it looks like a bear. And so I don't know how you could picture all of that together in one image, but that's what John is seeing. And I think that the image of the lion, the leopard, and the bear brings us back to the time of Daniel, when Daniel saw a similar one referring to the Greek, the Medo-Persian, and the Babylonian empires, and they were given different characteristics. And I think the idea behind this is that the reader would have understood this to be a combination of all that. So the power that was behind all of those empires now concentrated on this final power in the Roman Empire. And then look in verse 2, it says, "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his great authority." So if you recall, we remember what the dragon was. The dragon was an image for Satan working behind the scenes among various rulers to accomplish his purposes. And so we seem to have the same image here. Verse 3, "And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast." And so what is this deadly wound that occurred that now seems to be healed that caused so great of worship of the people? Well, I believe it refers to after the death of Nero in 68 AD, the Roman Empire went into turmoil, went into a civil war. And they had four different rulers in a year's time, each of them vying for power. And many thought that it was going to be the death of the empire because of this civil war that was taking place. And it wasn't until Vespasian left the region of the Promised Land and went back to claim the crown of Rome and started a whole new line of emperors in Rome that the Roman Empire was, in a way, brought back to life. It was during the struggle of 69 that this occurred. And then, of course, was brought back to life with Vespasian. So Revelation chapter 17, verse 10 is instructive on this. If you want to turn over a couple of chapters and look there. This, again, is talking about the beast and the woman riding on the beast, and talks about the different qualities of the beast and the character of the beast. And it gives some time designations here and some other illustrative understanding for us when it talks about the beast. And it says in verse 10 of chapter 17, "Five have fallen." And this is, of course, talking about the seven horns or the seven heads. And the five have fallen, that would be Julius Caesar, Augustus Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, Gaius Caligula Caesar, and Claudius Caesar. One is, it says, so that must have been Nero, who reigned from 54 to 68. And then it says one will occur after that for a little while. And that was Galba, who reigned for only 6 months from AD June 68 to June 69. Following Galba were Otha, Vitellius, both in 69, and then Vespasian finally came back in 69 and ruled for 10 years, followed by Titus. So historians write of the year 69 as the near death of the Roman Empire, but they also write of the enthroning of Vespasian as a deliverance, a revitalization, or a renewal of the Roman Empire. And so I believe what it's talking about here when it says that they saw one of the heads mortally wounded, but then brought back to life, it's referring to that period of time in the Roman Empire where there was this civil war that took place, and Vespasian came back and renewed the empire once again. And then verse 4, it says, "They worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?'" Upon the deliverance of the empire by Vespasian, it was stronger than it had ever been before. He revitalized it, obviously bringing back the 80,000 troops that were under his command, brought back Rome, strengthened it, centralized it once again, and it became stronger than it ever was before, and it lasted for another 200-300 years before it began to disintegrate once again. And so everybody was worshiping this place and these people, except one group of people, and that were the Christians. And we'll get to them here in just a moment. Verses 5 and 6, and it says, "And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Arrogant words and blasphemies, these were the treatments he had towards the temple, the tabernacle, and against the people of Israel and the church itself." And then 42 months is exactly the time that Nero persecuted the Christians after the fire. In November 64 until his suicide in June of 68 is exactly 42 months. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that this seems to be the case. This is Nero here. Verse 7. "And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe and tongue and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." So who are those that have their names written in the Lamb's book of life slain from the foundation of the world? It's Christians. Those are the only ones that it seems were not willing to bow down and to worship the Roman emperor and all of his authority. I think it's interesting what Tacitus writes here, and you bear with me here while I read some ancient historian Tacitus from the Annals, chapter 15, 44. It says, "Consequently, to get rid of the report," this is after Nero had burned down Rome. If you recall, I mentioned this in a previous sermon. After he had burned down Rome, he wanted to find a scapegoat in order to claim that he was not the one behind it. And so he begins to criticize the Christians. And it says, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite torture on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, arrest was made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle, and was exhibited to show in the circus, while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or stood aloft on a car. Hence, even for the criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one's man cruelty that they were being destroyed." So that's what a historian of Rome writes about Nero and his persecution of the Christians. And so in verse 8 it says, "All who dwell on the earth," means the known earth, obviously, the Roman Empire. "In the book of life, those who have their names in the citizenship of heaven were not the ones who were worshiping this beast." And then in verse 9 it says, "If anyone has ear, let him hear." The idea here is that although Nero was persecuting the Christians, he was also going to receive his same end by the same means that he was persecuting the Christians. And so we know that he actually took his life with the sword in 68 AD. And so that's the first beast, the beast out of the sea. Let's look at the second beast. We see that in verses 11 through verse 18. And the idea behind the second beast is the second beast is like a propagandist for the first beast. It is like a puppet for the first beast that is working to try to get people to worship the first beast. In verse 11 it says, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon." So this is a lamb in sheep's clothing. This is one who had two horns, meaning it's not as powerful as the one who had 10 horns. Verse 12, "And he exercises all authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So the idea is behind this is that this beast here is, its sole purpose is to get people to worship the first beast. Verse 13, he performs great signs so that even he makes the fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he has granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And so I think that what this represents is it represents many of the high priests at the time that Nero was ruling and right before that time. The high priests were actually appointed by the Roman kings, the Roman governors of the day. And they were wholeheartedly devoted to Rome. If you might imagine our current politics, and if you have somebody, let's say a judge who is supposed to be partial, but is appointed by a president, who do you think they're really going to be loyal to? And so that's why a lot of the times in our own politics we have corruption, because we have allegiance to various authorities. And so it's true in the first century as well, when you have the high priests that were appointed by Rome, who got all kinds of money and all kinds of favor and all kinds of power through their appointment, they were going to be loyal to the ones who appointed them. And so many of the high priests of the Jews were loyal to the rulers of Rome who had appointed them. And we have this interesting idea here in verses 13 and 14 about the signs and the wonders that were done. They were designed to try to deceive people into following after these Jewish leaders and all. And it reminds me of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 through 12, which says, "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them a strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." You see, in every age of conflict with God's people, there have been those who try to persuade away from the faith, whether it be through illusions or whether it be through false doctrine or false teaching. I think it's interesting that in the time of the plagues, if you recall Moses, Moses was sent by God to go into Pharaoh and to say, "Let my people go." And God said, if he doesn't let you go, which he's not going to, put down your staff and it will become a serpent. He puts down his staff. Well, what did the illusionists do? Egyptian magicians that were beside him do? They also created snakes, didn't they? So there's always been this competition with the enemy to try to copy what God is doing. And so it was true in the first century as well. I'm not going to look at each of these passages, but in the book of Acts, chapter 8, verse 99, we come across Simon the magician, who is trying to do all kinds of magical arts to try to get people away from Christianity. Chapter 13, verse 8, we have Elymas the magician. Chapter 16, verse 16, we have the fortune-telling girl. And then chapter 19, verse 19, we have the people of Ephesus bringing all of their magical books together and burning them. And so in the first century, there was a great deal of this magical cult that was taking place that was trying to persuade people away from the faith. There are all kinds of fanciful accounts of Simon doing everything from levitating to making statues move. And so what do we read about here in verses 14 and following? It says, "And he deceived those who dwell on the earth by the signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as who would not worship the beast, image of the beast, to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their forehead." So what is this mark? Again, we have all kinds of writings about what the mark of the beast is. And if you recall from an earlier message, I talked about the mark of the seal of God upon his people. And what was that? That was the Holy Spirit. So it's entirely possible that this is another mark that is not identifiable from the physical realm, but is something that is identifiable from the spiritual realm. But I think there might be something else to this as well. The forehead and the hand carries the idea of both in thought and in deed. But there was these receipts that began to become more and more common as the first century unfolded, called the libellus. And what they were is When you went into the places of worship among the Romans, you would have to bow down to their gods and bow down to Caesar, and there would be a bust of Caesar there, and you'd have to bow down to these gods. And when you left there, you were given a receipt called a libellus. It was given to you to show that you had paid your loyalty to the Roman Empire. And then from that, you would be able to take that to the marketplace and show that you had done your appropriate duty to the Romans. It's similar to what we would do today, of course, in our culture, by paying our taxes. Anytime you go to do something, they say, you know, let me see your tax form. Make sure that you've actually paid your taxes and that you're doing that. Well, they would do something similar. They would have a libellus there and they would write out that. Well, guess who didn't get those things? Christians. And why didn't they get a libellus? Because they refused to bow down to the image of Caesar, and they refused to bow down to the gods of the Romans. And so it's not without coincidence here that we can see that it's possible that they weren't able to buy and sell here because during this time of persecution under Nero, they weren't allowed because they didn't have the proper license to do so. And then in verse 18, it says, "Here is the wisdom, let him who understands calculate the number of the beast, for it is a number of a man. His number is 666. Now, here is my understanding of what this means. I believe that this was a cryptogram in Hebrew. Cryptogram is designed to be known by those who understand it and not known by those who don't understand it. And the word, the form of Caesar Nero in Hebrew would have been spelled out N-R-W-N-Q-S-R, because they don't use vowels. And so that's what it would have been when it's transliterated out into the Greek and into the Latin. And each of those letters are given numbers. So you would have had the numbers 50, 200, 6, 50, 100, 60, 200, which totals 666. So I believe what John is saying here is he is trying to indicate in a secretive way so that he doesn't get killed that this beast is Nero that's causing this persecution against the Christians. So let's summarize then. We have two powers working together against God's people, influenced by Satan, authorized by God himself. The Roman and the Jewish powers persecuting the church during the period under the reign of Nero. And I think it's interesting to note that we have here some methods that are used by the enemy that are consistent throughout time. Not only was this being done in the first century under Nero, but it's entirely possible that he's using the exact same methods today to persecute his people, or to persecute God's people. And so what are these methods? Well, there are a couple of them. First of all, deception. The enemy loves to use deception. He used the deception of power. We see this in verses 2, verse 4, verse 14, and verse 15. It says, "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him power, his throne, and his great authority." So Satan is using the powers of the state in order to deceive the people under the command. Verse 4, "So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?'" So they have convinced the people that there's no one who can compare to this ruler. And yet, of course, Christians know that there is one who can't compare, and that is Christ himself. Verse 14, "And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he has granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and live." And so he's able to deceive the people through the supposed power that is associated with that. Also, in verse 15, Satan is by his very nature deceptive. Listen to what it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 through 12. "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they do not receive the love of the truth." And he goes on, he says that he will give them a strong delusion. And then Matthew chapter 24, verses 4 and 5, it says, "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even even the elect. Power has a way of luring people in even when they don't necessarily want to. Excuse me. How many politicians go into Washington with the hope of bringing great change, positive change to our nation? And they say, we're going to go in there and we're going to make this change and this is going to be good and this change and it's going to be good. And they get there and then 2 years later, they're just like everyone else. What happened? Power corrupts, doesn't it? And absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so we see here the deception of power. Man is naturally intrigued by the mysterious and the powerful. This is probably why you'll see on television crowds and crowds gathering into Colosseums for a healing service. And you watch some of those things and people come up and much of it is rigged. Someone comes up and they're on a walker and they, you know, come up there and guy slaps them on the back or something and they drop their walker. And craziness! And yet people go in droves to watch that kind of stuff. Why? Because power deceives. It's not something that appears to be powerful and working that should deceive our attention or receive our attention, but worship of the only one who is truly all-powerful, and that is Christ. But we also see the deception of popularity. The deception of popularity. Look in verse 8. It says, all who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of the Lamb. And so this is all the earth, all the Roman Empire did this. They worshiped God. They worshiped the Caesar as God. They bowed down before him, because it was the popular thing to do. Verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave. In other words, the idea behind that is there's not a people group. There's not a demographic group that was not worshiping Caesar, except for the Christians. Popularity and peer pressure is so powerful and persuasive, isn't it? I remember just yesterday when I was thinking about this, I had gone to pick Samuel up because he had a hunter safety course he went to, and it was supposed to be over about 4:30. About 4:15, I get there in the parking lot, and I'm parking there, and I see some of the other parents in the parking lot as well. First thing I do when I pull up, I say, well, maybe I should go in there and see what's going on and what time there is. And I looked around, and I saw all the, no other parents are getting out of their car. They're all here. If you all just stay here. And then one by one, some of the parents started leaving their car. About three or four parents left the car, and finally I said, well, I'm going too. What happened? I just got caught up in what everybody else was doing. You see, there's a great deal of deception that's involved with popularity. There was actually a study done called the Ash Conformity Experiment. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but what happened was that they wanted to see how much pressure is put upon people when they are outside of what everybody else is thinking. And so they created this experiment where they had two cards. And one card had a line of a certain length on it. Another card had a line of another length on it. And they would show these cards to this class. But the catch was is that I think there was like 14 in the class who were told ahead of time what answers to give to these cards. And then there was one person in the class who was not told the right answers or what answers to give. And so they went through these cards. Sometimes they would be the same length as the one card. Sometimes they would be a different length. And inevitably, when the group chose a card that was not the same length and they said that it was, the guy in the class began to second guess. Because everybody else was saying that it was the same length. He would look at it again, kind of go like this. And, well, I guess maybe it is the same length. What happened? He conformed to the popularity, didn't he? It happens all the time. I remember growing up, I know you've probably never said this to your kids, but my parents said this to me all the time because I would come home and I'd say, well, everybody else is doing it. And what did they say? Well, you're not everybody else, right? You said that before? I know you have. It's nature for us to want to conform to what is popular. And yet, what is popular is not always what's right. There are all kinds of popular worship practices in the churches that are a far cry from what worship should be like. Things that are done in the churches that is a far cry from what God wants. I've mentioned before 7-Eleven songs, right? What are 7-Eleven songs designed to do? They're designed to get us into a certain mood. And so why did they go 7-Eleven times? Because the guitarist up there is going like this, and he realizes the church is not in the right mood. So what do they got to do? Sing it again. And sing it again. And sing it again. And dim the lights until finally everybody's in the right mood. Conformity. That's not right. Most popular preaching in churches across America today are those preaching like Joel Osteen. Some of you have probably heard of Joel Osteen. He was a huge, huge church in Texas. And you know what he preaches? Motivational, inspirational messages that have some allusions to Scripture, but certainly not scriptural. But it's popular, isn't it? You know what the most popular church is in Central Virginia? It's Powhatan Community Church. Growing like crazy. But do they preach the gospel there? I don't know. I've not been. I know the guy, pastor there, nice guy. But it's a seeker-sensitive church. You know what a seeker-sensitive church is?
What?
A seeker-sensitive church. It's designed to bring people into the church through just about any kind of means necessary and bring in huge crowds in, and then the assumption that they are seeking after God, and so you got to be able to present a message that they're wanting to hear. Well, that's not what the church is for, is it? The church is designed to gather for worship and scatter for evangelism, not gather for evangelism. And so there's all kinds of methods of popularity that are used in the churches today that are a far cry from what God's plan is for his people. And so we must not be deceived by the things that are popular. Rather, we must follow God's word alone, even if it means persecution. So the first thing we think is, no, I'm getting running way late on time here. And then we've got force is the second way in which he uses his method. And there's the threat of death in verse 15. We see that he is going to kill them off if they do not submit to his rule and to his worship. Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, it says, "And do not fear those who can kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." And yet man so often fears other men rather than doing what is right. Listen to what it, just a couple of reports that I looked up on the internet. In Santa Ana, California, January 18, 2003, Open Doors was confirmed the death of two Christians in North Korea. According to the ministry that serves persecuted Christians worldwide, one Christian was recently shot while he was on his way back to Bible training in China. The other died in one of North Korea's notorious labor camps. Washington Times on Tuesday, September 3rd, 2013, reports that Islamists gunned down five people in a roadside ambush near Nigeria's central city of Jos, only killing them after they declared their Christian faith. And then we see also that according to UN report, there are over 100,000 Christians killed yearly worldwide for their faith. See, one of the tactics the enemy uses is the threat of death. But that's not all. He also uses the threat of deprivation. Verses 16 and 17 says he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their forehead. And that no one should buy or sell except the one who has the mark on the name of the beast or the number of his name. And so here in this case, they were prevented from buying and selling unless they had this certain certificate that allowed them to do that. And in Philippians chapter 4, Paul, in regards to the persecution that he encountered, says that I do not speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. You see, he suffered a great deal of need. Threat of deprivation was common tactic of the enemy. You know, I don't know what it would be like if we were in a situation where we had to show some kind of credentials in order to buy our food. Now, we actually have to do this now, but it's not to the same extent. If you go to Sam's Club, I don't know how many of you have Sam's Club memberships or Price Club memberships. I love Sam's Club. Obviously, having a big family, we go buy a lot of stuff from Sam's Club because you get, you know, big cartons of everything. But one of the things I hate about Sam's Club is that you have to show a card to get in, and then you got to give them your card at checkout, and then they check your receipt when you leave. But imagine if that were the case, no matter what you bought. if you bought gas, you had to show your card every time. And in order to get that card, you had to profess faith in some foreign god. I wonder how many of us would be willing to do it. I think most of the time we would succumb. I hope that we wouldn't, but I think that there would be a lot of compromise. Satan has no attacks that are new. He uses the same methods over and over again. Whether it be the threat of death or the threat of intimidation, or whether it be some kind of force, or whether it be deception, he uses the same tactics over and over again. And so this can be instructive for us as well. And the question is, will you follow the deception of power or popularity, or will you show the evidence of having been written in the Lamb's book of life? And if these things were to come upon you, will you fall under the threat of death and deprivation, or will you show evidence of the mark of following Jesus and not of the enemy? Those who overcome, the scriptures say, resist the devil's ploys, demonstrates that their names are written in the Lamb's book of life. Our loyalty needs to be completely with the one who purchased us with his blood and him alone.
We start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?